Vicky paused as she crossed the yard to the warehouse, and she looked up at the sky. She not realized how late it was. There were only a few hours of daylight left, but the clouds seemed to be breaking up. The somber grey roof was higher, just on the peaks, and there were light patches where the sun tried to penetrate the cloud. She prayed quietly that it would not happen. Twice during these last desperate days the cloud had lifted briefly, and each time the Italian bombers had come roaring at low level up the gorge. On both occasions the terrible damage they'd inflicted had forced Gareth to abandon his trenches and pull back to the next prepared position, and a flood of wounded and dying had engulfed them here at the hospital.
"Let it rain," she prayed. "Please, God, let it rain. And rain."
She bowed her head and hurried on into the shed, into the stench and the low hubbub of groans and wails. She saw that Sarah was still assisting at the plain wooden table, inadequately screened by a tattered curtain of canvas and lit by a pair of Petromax lamps. The German doctor was removing a shattered limb, cutting below the knee, while the young Harari warrior thrashed weakly under the weight of the four orderlies who held him down. Vicky waited until they carried the patient away, and she called to Sarah. The two of them went out and stood breathing the sweet mountain air with relief as they leant close together under the overhanging roof of the veranda, while Vicky repeated the conversation she'd held with Lige Mikhail.
"Then we were cut off. The line just went dead."
"Yes," Sarah nodded. "They've cut the wires. It's only a surprise that Rascalar didn't do so before. The wires cross over the top of Amber Sakal. Perhaps it has taken this long for them to reach it."
"Will you go down the gorge, Sarah, and give the message to Major Swales?
I would go down to Miss Wobbly, but there is almost no fuel in the tank, and I have promised Jake not to waste it. We will need every drop later."
"It'll be quicker on horseback anyway," Sarah smiled. "And I will be able to see Gregorius."
"No, it won't take long," Vicky agreed. "They're very close." Both of them paused to listen to the Italian guns. The thumping detonations of the high explosive reverberated against the mountains, close enough to make the ground tremble under their feet.
"Don't you want me to give a message to Mr. Barton?" Sarah demanded archly. "Shall I tell him that your body craves..."
"No."
Vicky cut her short, her alarm obvious. "For goodness sake, don't go giving him one of your salacious inventions."
"What does salacious mean, Miss Camberwell?"
Sarah's interest was aroused immediately. "It means lecherous, lustful."
"Salacious."
Sarah repeated it, memorizing it.
"It is a fine word."
And with gusto, she tried it out.
"My body craves you with a great salacious yearning."
"Sarah, if you tell Jake that I said that, I will murder you with my bare hands,"
Vicky warned her, laughing for the first time in many days, and her laughter was cut off in mid-flight by the single ringing scream of terror and the wild animal roar that followed it. Suddenly, the goods yard was filled with racing figures. They poured out of the thick stand of cedar trees that flanked the railway line, and they crossed the tracks in a few leaping bounds. There were hundreds of them, and they poured into the warehouse and fell like a pack of wolves on the rows of helpless wounded.
"The Gallus,"
whispered Sarah huskily. And for a moment they stood paralyzed with horror, staring into the gloomy cavern of the shed. Vicky saw the old German doctor run to meet the Gallo wave, with his arms spread in a gesture of appeal, trying to prevent the slaughter. He took the thrust of a broadsword, full in the center of his chest, and a foot of the blade appeared magically from between his shoulder blades. She saw a Gala, armed with a magazine-loaded rifle, run down a line of wounded, pausing to fire a single shot at point-blank range into each head. She saw another with a long dagger in his hand, not bothering even to slit the throat of the Harari wounded, before he jerked aside the covering of coarse jute bags and his dagger swept in a single cutting stroke across the exposed lower belly. She saw the shed filled with frenzied figures, their sword arms rising and falling, their gunfire crashing into the supine bodies, and the screams of their victims ringing against the high roof, blending with the high excited laughter and the wild cries of the gala. Sara dragged Vicky away, pulling her back behind the sheltering wall of the shed. It broke the spell of horror which had mesmerized Vicky, and she ran beside the girl on flying feet. "The car," she panted. "If we can reach the car." Miss Wobbly was parked beyond the station buildings under the lean-to of the loco shed, where it was protected from the rain. Running side by side, Vicky and Sara turned the corner of the shed and ran almost into the arms of a dozen gallas, coming at a run in the opposite direction. Vicky had a glimpse of their dark faces, shining with rain and sweat, of the open mouths and flashing wolf-like teeth, the mad staring eyes, and she smelt them, the hot, excited animal smell of their sweat. Then she was twisting away, like a hare jinking out of the track of a hound. A hand clutched at her shoulder, and she felt her blouse tear. Then she was free and running, but she could hear the pounding of their feet close behind her and the crazy lulooing of excitement as they chased. Sara ran with her, jawing slightly ahead as they reached the corner of the station building. There was the flash and the crack of a rifle shot out into their left, and the bullet slammed into the wall beside them. From the corner of her eye, Vicky saw other running gallas, racing in from the main road of the village, their long chamois flapping about them as they ran to head them off. Sara was drawing away from her. The girl ran with the grace and speed of a gazelle, and Vicky couldn't keep pace with her. She rounded the corner of the station building 10 paces ahead of Vicky and stopped abruptly. Under the lean-to shelter, the angular shape of Miss Wobbly was wreathed in furious petals of crimson flame, and the black, oily smoke poured from her hatches. The gallus had reached her first. She'd clearly been one of their first targets, and dozens of them pranced around her as she burned, and then scattered as the vicar's ammunition in the bins began exploding. Sarah had halted only for a second, but it was long enough for Vicky to reach her. "The cedar forest," gasped Sarah, a hand on Vicky's arm as they changed direction. The forest was 200 yards away across the tracks, but it was dense and dark, covering the broken ground along the river. They raced out into the open, and immediately 20 other gallus took up the chase, their voices raised in the pack clamour. The open yard seemed to stretch to eternity as Vicky ran on ahead of the gallus. The ground was slushy, so that she sank to the ankles with each step, and the clinging red mud sucked one of her shoes off her foot. So she ran on lopsidedly, her feet sliding and her knees turning weak under her. Sara raced on lightly ahead, leaping the steel railway track and her feet flying lightly over the muddy ground. The edge of the forest was 50 feet away. Vicky felt a foot catch as she tried to jump the tracks, and she went down sprawling in the mud. She dragged herself to her knees. On the edge of the forest, Sara looked back, hesitating, her eyes huge and glistening white in her smooth, dark face. "Run!" screamed Vicky. "Run! Tell Jake!" And the girl was gone in the dark forest, with only a flicker of her passing like a forest doe. The butt of a rifle struck Vicky in the side, below the ribs, and she went down with an explosive grunt of pain into the cold red mud. Then there were hands tearing at her clothing, and she tried to fight, but she was blinded by the clinging wet tresses of her hair and crippled with the pain of the blow. They hoisted her to her feet, and suddenly a new authoritative voice cracked like a whiplash, and the hands released her. She lifted her head, hunched up over her bruised belly, and sighed. Through eyes blurred with tears and mud, she recognized the scarred face of the gala captain. He still wore the blue chamois, sodden now with rain, and the scar twisted his grin, making it seem even more cruel and vicious. The front edge of the trench had been reinforced with sandbags and screened with brush, and through the square observation aperture, the view down the gorge was uninterrupted. Gareth propped one shoulder against the sandbags and peered down into the gathering gloom. Jake Barton squatted on the firing step beside him and studied the Englishman's face. Gareth Swales's usually immaculate turnout was now red with dried mud and stained with sweat, rainwater and filth. A thick golden stubble of beard covered his jaw, like the pelt of an otter, and his moustache was ragged and untrimmed. There had been no opportunity to change clothing or bathe in the last week. There were new lines etched deeply into the corners of his mouth, his forehead and around his eyes, lines of pain and worry. But when he glanced up and caught Jake's scrutiny, he grinned and lifted an eyebrow, and the old devilish gleam was in his eyes. He was about to speak when, from below them, another shell came, howling up through the deep shades of the gorge, and both of them ducked instinctively as it burst in close. But neither of them remarked. There had been hundreds of bursts that close in the last days. "It's breaking for certain," Gareth observed instead, and they both looked up at the strip of sky that showed between the mountains. "Yeah," Jake agreed. "But it's too late. It'll be dark in 20 minutes. It would be too late for the bombers, even if the cloud lifted completely. From bitter experience, they knew how long it took for the aircraft to reach them from the airfield at Chaldee. "It'll clear again tomorrow," Gareth answered. "Tomorrow's another day," Jake said. But his mind dwelt on the big black machines. The Italian artillery fired smoke markers onto their trenches just as soon as they heard the drone of approaching engines in the open, cloudless sky. The Capronis came in very low, their wingtips seeming to scrape the rocky walls on each side of the gorge. The beat of their engines rose to an unbearable, ear-shattering roar, and they were so close that they could make out the features of the helmeted heads of the airmen in the round glass cockpits. Then, as they flashed overhead, the black objects detached from under their fuselage. The 100-kilo bombs dropped straight, their flight controlled by the fins. And when they struck, the explosion shocked the mind and numbed the body. In comparison, the burst of an artillery shell was a squib. The canisters of nitrogen mustard were not aerodynamically stable, and they tumbled end over end and burst against the rocky slopes in a splash of yellow jelly-like liquid that sprayed for hundreds of feet in all directions. Each time the bombers had come, one after the other, endlessly, hour after hour, they left the defense so broken that the wave of infantry that followed them could not be repelled. Each time they'd been driven out of their trenches to toil back upwards to the next line of defense. This was the last line. 2 miles behind them stood the granite portals that headed the gorge, and beyond them the town of Sardi on the open way to the Desi Road. "Why don't you try and get a little sleep?" Jake suggested, and involuntarily glanced down at Gareth's arm. It was swathed in strips of torn shirt and suspended in a makeshift sling from around his neck. The discharge of lymph and pus and the coating of engine grease had soaked through the crude bandage. It was an ugly sight, covered, but Jake remembered what it would look like without the bandage. The nitrogen mustard had flayed it from shoulder to wrist, as though it had been plunged into a pot of boiling water. Jake wondered how much good the coating of grease was doing it. There was no other treatment, however, and at least it kept the air from the terrible injury. "I'll wait until dark," Gareth murmured, and with his good hand lifted the binoculars to his eyes. "I've got a funny feeling. Too quiet down there." They were silent again, the silence of extreme exhaustion. "It's too quiet," said Gareth again, and winced as he moved the arm. "They haven't got time to sit around like this. They've got to keep pushing, pushing." And then, irrelevantly, "God, I'd give one testicle for a cheroot. Oh, Romeo et Juliet." He broke off abruptly, and then both of them straightened out. "Do you hear what I think I hear?" asked Gareth. "I think I do." "Had to come, of course," said Gareth. "I'm only surprised it took this long. But it's a long, hard ride from Asmara to here. So that's what they'd be waiting for." The sound was unmistakable in the brooding silence of the gorge, funneled up to them by the rock walls. It was faint still, but there was no doubting the clanking clatter and the shrill squeak of turning steel tracks. Each second it grew clearer, and now they could hear the soft growl of the engines. That has got to be the most unholy sound in the world, said Jake.
Tanks, said Gareth. Bloody tanks.
They won't get here before dark, Jake guessed. And they won't risk a night attack.
No, Gareth agreed. They'll come at dawn.
Tanks and Capronis instead of ham and eggs?
Gareth shrugged wearily.
That's about the size of it, old son.
Count Colonel Aldo Belli was not at all certain of the wisdom of his actions, and he thought that Gino was justified in looking up at him with those reproachful spaniel's eyes. They should have been still comfortably ensconced behind the formidable defences of Chaldy Wells. However, a number of powerful influences had combined to drive him forward once again. Not the least powerful of these were the daily radio messages from General Badoglio's headquarters, urging him to intersect the Desi Road, before the fish slips through our net. These messages were daily more harsh and threatening in character, and were immediately passed on, with the Count's own embellishments, to Major Louis Castellani, who had command of the column struggling up the gorge. Now at last, Castellani had radioed back to the Count the welcome news that he stood at the very head of the gorge, and the next push would carry him into the town of Sardi itself. The Count had decided, after long and deep meditation, that to ride into the enemy's stronghold at the moment of its capture would so enhance his reputation as to be worth the small danger involved. Major Castellani had assured him that the enemy was broken and whipped, had suffered enormous casualties, and was no longer a coherent fighting force. Those odds were acceptable to the Count. The final circumstance that persuaded him to leave the camp, abandon the new military philosophy, and move cautiously up the Sardi Gorge, was the arrival of the armoured column from Asmara. These machines were to replace those that the savage enemy had so perfidiously trapped and burned. Despite all the Count's pleading and blustering, it had taken a week for them to be diverted from Massawa, brought up to Asmara by train, and then for them to complete the long, slow crossing of the Dannock Hill. Now, however, they had arrived, and the Count had immediately requisitioned one of the six tanks as his personal command vehicle. Once he was within the thick armoured hull, he had experienced a new flood of confidence and courage.
"Onward to Sardi, to write in blood upon the glorious pages of history," were the words that occurred to him, and Gino's face had creased up in that spaniel's expression. Now, in the lowering shades of evening, grinding up the rocky pathway, while walls of sheer rock rose on either hand, seeming to meet the sullen purple strip of sky high above, the Count was having serious doubts about the whole wild venture. He peered out of the turret of his command tank, his eyes huge and dark and melting with apprehension, a black polished steel helmet pulled down firmly over his ears, and one hand gripping the ivory butt of the Beretta so fiercely that his knuckles shone white as bone china. At his feet, Gino crouched miserably, keeping well down within the steel hull. At that moment, a machine gun opened fire ahead of them, and the sound echoed and re-echoed against the sheer walls of the gorge.
"Stop! Stop! This instant!" shouted the Count at his driver.
The gunfire sounded very close ahead.
"We will make this battalion headquarters right here," announced the Count,
and Gino perked up a little and nodded his total agreement.
"Send for Major Castellani and Major Vito. They are to report to me here immediately."
Jake awoke to the pressure of somebody's hand on his shoulder, and the light of a storm lantern in his eyes. The effort of sitting up required all his determination, and he let the damp blanket fall and screwed up his eyes against the light. The cold had stiffened every muscle in his body, and his head felt light and woolly with fatigue. He could not believe it was morning already.
"Who is it?"
"It's me, Jake."
And then he saw Gregorius's dark, intense face beyond the lamp.
"Take that bloody thing out of my eyes."
Beside him, Gareth Swales sat up suddenly. Both of them had been sleeping fully dressed upon the same ragged strip of canvas in the muddy bottom of the dugout.
"What's going on?"
mumbled Gareth, also stupid with fatigue. Gregorius swung the lantern aside, and the light fell on the slim figure beside him. Sara was shivering with cold, and her light clothing was sodden and muddy. Thorn and branches had scored bloody lines across her legs and arms and ripped the fabric of her breeches. She dropped on her knees beside Jake, and he saw that her eyes were haunted with terror and horror. Her lips trembled uncontrollably, and the slim hand she laid on Jake's arm was cold as a dead man's, but it fluttered urgently.
"Miss Camberwell, they have taken her,"
she blurted wildly, and her voice choked up. "You should stay on here," Jake muttered, and they hurried up the slope to where Priscilla the pig was parked, half a mile back from the line of trenches. "This'll be a dawn attack. They'll need you." "I'm coming on the ride, Jake," Gareth answered quietly, but firmly. "You can't expect me to sit here while Vicky..." He broke off. "Got to keep a fatherly eye on you, old son," he went on in the old bantering tone. "The Ras and his lads will have to take their own chances for a while." As he spoke, they reached the hulking shape of the armored car, parked in the broken ground below the head of the gorge. Jake began to drag the canvas cover off the vehicle, and Gareth drew Gregorius aside. "One way or the other, we should be back before dawn. If we aren't, you know what to do. God knows you've had enough practice these last few days." Gregorius nodded silently. "Hold on as long as you can. Then turn back to the head of the gorge for the last act, right? It's only until noon tomorrow. We can hold them that long. Tanks are no bloody tanks, can't we?" "Yes, we can hold them. Just one other thing, Greg. I love your grandfather like a brother, but keep that old bastard under control, will you? Even if you have to tie him down." Gareth slapped the boy's shoulder, changed the captured Italian rifle into his good hand, and hurried back to the car, just as Jake boosted Sara up the side of the hull and then ran to the crank handle. Priscilla the pig ground up the last few hundred yards of the steep ground to the head of the gorge, and they passed gangs of Harari working by torchlight. They'd been at it in shifts since the previous evening, when Jake and Gareth had heard the Italian tanks coming up the gorge. Although all his concern was with Vicky, yet Gareth noted almost mechanically that the work gang had performed their task well. The anti-tank walls were higher than a man's head and built from the heaviest, most massive boulders that could be carried down from the cliffs. There was only a gap narrow enough to allow the car to pass in the centre of the walls. "Tell him to close the gap now, Zara. We won't take the car into the gorge again," Gareth instructed quietly. As they went through, she called out to a Harari officer who stood on top of the highest point of the wall. He waved an acknowledgement and turned away to supervise the work. Jake took the car through the natural granite gates, and beyond them lay the saucer-shaped valley and the town of Sardi. It was burning, and at the sight, Jake halted the car, and they stood on the hull and looked across at the ruddy glow of the flames that lit the underbelly of the clouds and dimly defined the mountain masses that enclosed the valley. "Is she still alive?" Jake voiced all their fears, but it was Sara who answered. "If Rascolar was there when they caught her, then she is dead." Then silence again, both men staring out into the night, with anger and dread holding them captive. "But if he was skulking up in the hills, as he usually does, waiting for the attack to succeed before he shows himself," she spat expressively over the side of the hull, "then his men would not dare begin the execution until he was there to watch and enjoy the work of his milch cows. I've heard they can take the skin off a living body, working carefully with their knives, every inch of skin from head to toes, and the body still lives for many hours." Jake shuddered with horror. "If you're ready, old boy, I think we could move on now," said Gareth. And with an effort, Jake aroused himself and dropped back into the driver's hatch. There seemed to be a suggestion of the false dawn lightening the narrow strip of sky high above the mountains when Gregorius Mariam scrambled back into the frontline trenches. There was activity already amongst the shadowy figures that crowded the narrow dugouts, and one of the Ras's bodyguards carrying a smoky paraffin lantern, greeted him with relief. "The Ras asks for you." Gregorius followed him down the trench, stepping carefully among the hundreds of figures that slept uncaring on the muddy floor. The Ras sat huddled in a grey blanket in one of the larger dugouts off the main trench. The open pit had been roofed in with the remnants of one of the leather tents, and a small fire burned smokily at the centre. The Ras was surrounded by a dozen of the officers of his bodyguard, and he looked up as Gregorius knelt quietly before him.
"The white men have gone?"
the Ras asked, and coughed, a hacking old man's cough that shook his whole frail body.
"They will return in the dawn before the enemy attack," Gregorius defended them quickly, and went on to explain the reasons and the change of plans.
The Ras nodded, staring into the flickering fire, and when Gregorius paused, he spoke again in that rasping, querulous tone.
"It is a sign, and I would have it no other way. Too long I have listened to the counsel of the Englishmen. Too long I have quenched the fire in my belly. Too long I have slunk like a dog from the enemy."
He coughed again, painfully.
"We have run far enough. The time has come to fight."
And his officers growled angrily in the gloom around him, and swayed closer to listen to his words.
"Go you to your men, rouse them, fill their bellies with fire and their hands with steel. Tell them that the signal will be as it was 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. Tell them to listen for my war drums."
A suppressed roar of exultation came from their throats.
"The drums will beat up the dawn, and when they cease, that will be the moment."
The Ras had struggled to his feet, and he stood naked above them, the blanket fallen away, and his skinny old chest heaved with the passion of his anger.
"In that moment, I, Ras Ghulam, will go down to drive the enemy back across the desert and into the sea from which they came. Every man who calls himself a warrior and an Harari will go down with me."
And his voice was lost in the shrill lulooing of his officers. And the Ras laughed with the high ringing laugh close to madness. One of his officers handed him a mug of the fiery Tej, and the Ras poured it down his throat in a single draught, then hurled the mug upon the fire. Gregorius leapt to his feet and laid a restraining hand upon the skinny old arm.
"Grandfather!"
The Ras swung round to him, the bloodshot, rheumy eyes burning with a fierce new light.
"If you have woman's words to say to me, then swallow them, and let them choke the breath in your lungs and turn to poison in your belly."
The Ras glared at his grandson, and suddenly Gregorius understood. He understood what the Ras was about to do. He was a man old and wise enough to know that his world was passing, that the enemy was too strong, that God had turned his back upon Ethiopia, that no matter how brave the heart and how fierce the battle, in the end there was defeat and dishonor and slavery. The Ras was choosing the other way. The only other way. The flash of understanding passed between the youth and the ancient, and the Ras's eyes softened, and he leaned towards Gregorius.
"But if the fire is also in your belly, if you will charge beside me when the drums fall silent, then kneel for my blessing."
Suddenly Gregorius felt all care and restraint fall away, and his heart soared up like an eagle, borne aloft by the ancient atavistic joy of the warrior. He fell on one knee before the Ras.
"Give me your blessing, grandfather," he cried.
And the Ras placed both hands upon his bowed head and mumbled the biblical words. A warm, soft drop fell upon Gregorius's neck, and he looked up, startled. The tears were running down the dark, wrinkled cheeks and dripping unashamedly from the Ras's chin. Vicky Camberwell lay face down upon the filthy earthen floor of one of the deserted tukuls on the outskirts of the burning town. The floor swarmed with legions of lice, and they crawled softly over her skin, and their bites set up a burning irritation. Her hands were bound behind her back with strips of rawhide rope, and her ankles were bound the same way. Outside, she could hear the rustle and crackle of the burning town, with an occasional louder crash as a roof collapsed. There were also shouts of and wild laughter of the Gallus, drunk on blood and tedge, and the chilling sound of the few Harari captives who'd been saved from the initial massacre to provide entertainment during the long wait before Ras Kula arrived in the captured town. Vicky did not know how long she'd lain. Her hands and feet were without feeling, for the rawhide ropes were tightly knotted. Her ribs ached from the blow that had felled her, and the icy cold of the mountain night had permeated her whole body, so that the marrow in her bones ached with it, and fits of shivering racked her, as though she were in fever. Her teeth chattered uncontrollably, and her lips were blue and tight, but she could not move. Any attempt to alter her position or relieve her cramped limbs was immediately greeted with a blow or a kick from the guards who stood over her. At last her mind blacked out, not into sleep, for she could still dimly hear the din from around the hut, but into a kind of coma in which sense of time was lost, and the acute discomfort of the cold and her bonds receded. Hours must have passed in this stupor of exhaustion and cold, when she was roused by another kick in her stomach, and she gasped and sobbed with the fresh pain of it. She was aware immediately of a change in the volume of sound outside the hut. There were many hundreds of voices raised in an excited roar, like that of a crowd at a circus. A guard dragged her roughly to her feet, and one of them stooped to cut the rawhide that bound her ankles, and then straightened to do the same to those at her wrists. Vicky sobbed at the bright agony of blood flowing back into her feet and hands. Her legs collapsed under her, and she would have fallen. But rough hands held her and dragged her forward on her knees, towards the low entrance of the hut. Outside, there was a dense pack of bodies that filled the narrow street, dark, menacing figures that pressed forward eagerly as she appeared in the entrance of the hut, and a blood-crazed roar went up from the crowd. Her guards dragged her forward along the street, and the crowds swarmed forward, keeping pace with her, and the roar of their voices was like the sound of a winter storm. Hands clutched at her, and her guards beat them away laughingly and hustled her onwards, with her paralyzed legs flopping weakly under her. They carried her forward into the goods yard of the railways, through the steel gate, past the mountainous pile of naked, mutilated corpses, all that remained of men who she'd helped to nurse. The yard was lit by the smoky, fluttering light of hundreds of torches, and it was only when she was almost up to the warehouse veranda that she recognized the figure that lolled indolently upon the cushions, using the raised concrete ramp as a grandstand from which to direct and watch the execution. Vicky's terror came rushing back, like a black, icy flood, and she tried desperately to twist herself free of the clutching hands, but they carried her forward and then lifted her suddenly. Three of the heavy Gala lances had been set into the soft earth of the yard in a form of a tripod, with the steel lance tips bound firmly at the apex of the pyramid. With a force that she could not resist, her arms and legs were spread, and again she felt the lashing of rawhide at her wrists and ankles. Her captors fell back into a circle, and she found herself suspended from the tripod of lances like a starfish, and the weight of her body cut the leather straps viciously into her flesh. She looked up. Directly above her, on the concrete ramp, sat Ras Kula. He said something to her, in a high, piping voice, but she did not understand the words, and she could only stare in fascinated terror at his thick, soft lips. The tip of his tongue came out and ran slowly across his lips, like a fat, golden cat. He giggled suddenly, motioned to the two women who flanked him on the cushions. They came down into the yard with their silver jewellery tinkling and the multicoloured silk of their robes glowing in the lamplight like the plumage of two beautiful birds of paradise. As though they'd rehearsed their movements, one went to each side of Vicky as she hung on the tripod of lances. Their faces were serene, remote, and lovely as two exotic blooms on the long graceful stems of their necks. It was only when they reached up to touch her that Vicky saw the little silver knives in their hands, and she wriggled helplessly, her head twisting to watch the blades. With expert economical movements, The two women slit the fabric of Vicky's clothing, from the yoke of her blouse at the throat, down in a single stroke to the hem of her skirt, and the dress fell away like an autumn leaf and dropped into the mud below her. Rascular clapped his hands with glee, and the dense pack of dark bodies swayed and growled, pressing a little closer. With the same unhurried knife strokes, the sheer silk of Vicky's underwear was cut away and discarded, and she hung there naked and vulnerable, unable to cover her pale, smooth body with the long, finely sculptured limbs, spread and pinioned. She dropped her head forward so that the golden hair fell forward and covered her face. One of the gala women moved around until she faced Vicky directly. She reached out with the little silver knife and touched the point of the white skin just below the base of her throat, where a pulse beat visibly, like a tiny trapped animal, and slowly, achingly slowly, she drew the blade downwards. Vicky's whole body convulsed, every limb stiffened, and her back arched rigidly, so that the shape of the muscles stood out clearly beneath the smooth, unblemished skin. Her head flew back, her eyes wide and staring, her mouth gaping open, and she screamed. The woman drew the knife on downwards, between the tense, straining breasts. The white skin opened to the shallow, carefully controlled razor point, and a vivid scarlet line marked the slow track of the blade as it moved on inexorably downwards. The voice of the crowd rose, a gathering roar like the sound of a storm wind coming from afar, and Rascular leaned forward on his cushions. His eyes shone, and the wet pink lips were parted. Two things happened simultaneously. From the darkness beyond the station buildings, Priscilla the pig burst out into the torch-lit area. Up until that moment, when Jake Barton thrust down fully on the throttle, the gentle hum of the engine had been drowned by the animal roar of the crowd. The heavy steel hull, driven by the full thrust of the old Bentley engine, ploughed into the crowd and went through it like a combine harvester through a field of standing wheat. Without any slackening of speed, it tore a pathway through the dense pack directly towards the clearing where Vicky hung on the tripod of lances. At the same moment, Gareth Swales stepped out of the black oblong of the warehouse door, directly behind where Rascular sat. He had the Italian rifle over the crook of his injured arm, and he fired without lifting the butt to his shoulder. The bullet smashed into the elbow of the gala woman's knife arm, and the arm snapped like a twig. The knife flew from the nerveless fingers, and the woman shrieked and collapsed into the mud at Vicky's feet. The second woman swirled, her right hand drew back like the head of a striking adder, and she aimed the knife blade at Vicky's soft, white stomach. As she began the stroke that would plunge it hilt deep, Gareth moved the rifle muzzle fractionally and fired again. The heavy bullet caught the woman in the exact center of her golden forehead. The black hole appeared there like a third empty eye socket, and her head snapped backwards as though from a heavy blow. As she went down, Gareth worked the bolt of the rifle and dropped the muzzle, again only fractionally. But as Rascular twisted around desperately on his cushions, his mouth wide open and a gurgling cry keening from the thick, wet lips, the muzzle of the rifle was aimed directly into the pink pit of his throat, and Gareth fired the third shot. It shattered the front teeth in Rascular's upper jaw before plunging on into his throat and then exiting through the back of his neck. The Ras went over backwards and flapped and jumped like a maimed frog. Gareth stepped over him and jumped down lightly into the yard. A gala rushed at him with a broadsword held high above his head. Gareth fired again without lifting the rifle, stepped over the body and reached Vicky's side just as Jake Barton swung the car to a skidding halt next to them and tumbled out of the driver's hatch with a Harari dagger in his hand. In the turret above them, Sara fired the Vickers in a long continuous blast, swinging it back and forth in its limited traverse, and the gala crowd scattered panic-stricken into the night. Jake slashed the thongs that held Vicky suspended, and she fell forward into his arms. Gareth stooped and gathered Vicky's torn clothing out of the mud and bundled it under his injured armpit. "Shall we move on now, old son?" he he asked Jake genially. I think the fun's over. And between them, they lifted Vicky up the side of the hull. The drums brought Count Aldo Billy out of a troubled, dream-plagued sleep, and he sat bolt upright from his hard couch on the floorboards of the hull, with his eyes wide and staring, and fumbled frantically for his pistol.
Gino! He shouted, Gino!
And there was no reply. Only that terrible rhythm in the night, pounding against his head, so that he thought it might drive him mad. He tried to close his ears, pressing the palms of his hands to them, but the sound came through like a gigantic pulse, the heartbeat of this cruel and savage land. He could bear it no longer, and he crawled up inside the hull until he reached the far hatch of the tank and thrust his head out.
Gino!
He was answered instantly. The little sergeant's head popped up from where he'd been cowering in his blankets on the rocky ground between the steel tracks. The Count could hear his teeth clattering in his skull like typewriter keys.
Send the driver to fetch Major Castellani immediately.
Immediately. Gino's head disappeared, and a few moments later appeared again so abruptly that the Count let out a startled cry and pointed the loaded pistol between his eyes.
Excellency,
squawked Gino.
Idiot,
snarled the Count, his voice husky with terror.
I could have killed you. Don't you realize I have the reactions of a leopard? Excellency, may I enter the machine?
Aldo Belli thought about the request for a moment, and then enjoyed a perverse pleasure in refusing. Make me a cup of coffee, he ordered. But when it came, he found that the incessant cacophony of drums that filled his head had worked on his nerves to the point where he couldn't hold the mug steady, and the rim rattled against his teeth.
Goat's urine,
snapped the Count, hoping that Gino had not noticed the unsteady hand.
You're trying to poison me,
he accused, and tossed the steaming liquid over the side. And at that moment, the stocky figure of the Major loomed out of the darkness of the gorge.
The men are standing too, Colonel, he growled. In another 15 minutes it will be light enough.
Good, good, the Count cut him short.
I've decided that I should return immediately to headquarters. General Bagdoglio will expect me.
Excellent, Colonel, the Major interrupted in his turn. I have received intelligence that large bands of the enemy have infiltrated our lines and are operating in the rear areas. There is a good chance you might be able to bring them to account.
Castellani, by this time, knew his man intimately.
Of course, with the small escort that can be spared, it will be a desperate business.
On the other hand, the Count mused aloud, I wonder if my heart does not lie here, with my boys. There comes a time when a warrior must trust his heart rather than his head. And I warn you, Castellani, my fighting blood is aroused.
Indeed, Colonel.
I shall move up immediately,
announced Aldo Belli, and glanced anxiously back into the dark depths of the gorge. His intention was to place his command tank fairly in the center of the armored column, protected from both front and rear.